proceed with the next case of the morning, with his JCW Investments versus Novelty Incorporated. Mr. Luders?
Yes, Your Honor.
I guess we heard the first sentence of your argument.
Indeed, my client decided to represent himself pro se. May it please the court, I, along with my partner, Dr. Lisa Heide, represent Fart Man and Fart Boy. And this case involves whether another corporation can monopolize that which is classic, that which we all know and love. Their own documents admit that the classic pose is a male sitting in an easy chair, smiling and extending his finger with the well-known pull-my-finger joke where the kid pulls the finger and you fart and you tell a joke about it, and the kid giggles because it seems to be a causal relationship between pulling the finger and the flatulence. The district court, frankly, rushed to judgment. He granted a preliminary injunction on a product that wasn't even being sold without so much as a hearing and without any discovery. Later on, in the fees ruling, in a moment of candor, he characterized my client's product as so obviously a knockoff. That thinking, presumably formed at the early preliminary injunction stages, carried over to the summary judgment ruling, where he ruled as a matter of law that no reasonable person could conclude there's not copyright infringement. The judge committed an error of law, and it is a question of law, dividing the public domain versus what's private property that a corporation can monopolize for the life of an author plus 50 years. At bottom, this is it's a goofy, funny little product, but it's an important issue of how much can you monopolize?
Well, and, you know, this court has certainly seen things like that before. I'm thinking of our long line of Beanie Baby cases, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and absolute identity isn't required. So, you know, the fact that one has a hat and the other doesn't have a hat in and of itself is not enough to prevent the finding of copying. And I guess I have trouble, you know, looking at these, understanding how it is, you know, that every last detail that you have listed are all just inherent in the public domain. I mean, there's chair, not chair, colors, you know, hair, a million little details. And we have lots of cases that say once you've crossed over the line and there's substantial identity, that's enough.
Respectfully, the colors are all different except for blue jeans and a white shirt. The shirt is different.
Well, the race is the same. The mouth is quite similar. It's kind of a potato-y sort of nose. The eyes are similar. They're both sitting in an easy chair. True, the chairs are a different color. I don't disagree with that.
The shoes are a different color. The potato-y nose is a function of functionality of making plush dolls. When you stitch plush dolls, that's just the attribute of the soft, rounded features of a plush doll. I agree, if you just focus on one little aspect, you can pick it apart on either side.
Well, I mean, go ahead.
See, I have a hard time calling up with Judge Wood's question, looking at this and believing that this was a fart man, I hate to use that word, but that he was a completely independent creation, that no one looked at that and said, well, let's get about as close as we can to Fred, but not be identical, but close enough so that people who maybe have heard about Fred will buy our product instead.
You're right. It was not a completely independent creation. We copied the idea. We have admitted that from the first filing of the injunction.
Well, it's the embodiment of the idea.
No, sir. No, that's the point. It is an independent creation of the expression of the idea.
Well, but just to follow up on that, you say you copied the idea, but if Mr. Green stood there and said, I want it to be a middle-aged white male sitting in an easy chair, wearing blue jeans with a goofy grin and five teeth and, you know, big eyes. And I mean, there's enough. At some point, you have described Fred, and any good artist could sit down and basically draw it.
Bubba is the demographic nickname of my client's customer. He sells the convenience store. In the convenience store industry, they literally call their demographic customer Bubba. He's a white male. He smokes cigarettes. He wears jeans. He drinks beer. He farts. He's a crude individual. Candidly, I didn't know the pull-my-finger joke before I took this lawsuit. As I got into discovery, I found out that in that demographic segment of a country, it's very well known. And indeed, the plaintiff respectfully admitted that. So when you say white male, blue jeans, T-shirt, sitting in an easy chair, that's Bubba. So Todd Green comes back and tells his art department, make Bubba sitting down and, you know, doing the pull-my-finger joke. That code word conveys a lot of these very common attributes.
Well, you say that, but actually your opponent's own product line includes another of these dolls, Frankie, that's different. You know, it's blonde, white and red striped tank top, tattoo. I mean, there's so many ways you can depict Bubba, frankly. Go to a NASCAR, you know, event or something.
Consider the ramifications of that. They have, I don't know, 10, 15 different dolls. They've got a vampire. They've got a Santa Claus. They cut or came out after our Santa Claus. With an array of product lines, they can effectively monopolize the farting doll market.
But
they can always
find
one.
They haven't done it. They only have, you know, a finite number of them out. It's like the Supreme Court had a case some years back where people were worried about whether you could monopolize a particular color. And, in fact, there are so many colors, the court said, well, you know, there's just this one distinctive, some kind of ugly green color that they used on dry cleaning materials. And they said, we're not there yet. You know, we haven't seen the entire color wheel monopolized. And I would say the same. I think at the moment the variety among these products suggest if you'd wanted to be in that market, you easily could have done it in a way that wasn't a knockoff of Fred.
But imagine, put yourself in the shoes of Mary Burkhart, the artist. Her boss walks in and says, I've been to China. I saw their product. I want to copy the idea. What's the idea? It's Bubba sitting in an easy chair. You pull his finger and he farts and tells jokes. Okay, fine. I mean, she cranks that out. She knows who Bubba is. She knows the pull my finger joke. Because she's in that world of the Bubba demographic. What else would you expect her to come up with? I mean, she had expression. Sure, there's similarity, but what are the similarities? The male sitting in the easy chair, smiling, his finger extended, he tells, you know, the fart and the joke. He's got blue jeans, white T-shirt, and dark hair. None of those things are especially notable forms of expression. Caucasian is the most common race.
And the hair is dark. The same.
No, they're not. The only thing that's same about them is they're dark. That's the most common hair color. Blonde and red is the least is less common than dark. You know, Bubba is a male. He's not a woman. You know, sitting in an easy chair, that's part of the classic pose according to the plaintiff's own literature. Why? I hate to be crude, but because the classic pose usually happens after you've had a big meal, and that's when you tend to fart, frankly, and you sprawl out in an easy chair. That's why it's part of the shtick. Everyone understands the joke. It's crude, and it's not the kind of things that, you know, lawyers and federal judges, I was never exposed to it, but once you delve into this world, it's like, holy cow, this is a well-known joke in this segment. And so when you start from that public domain, you can't just say, well, gee, they can monopolize it, and shame on you because you copied the idea. The Supreme Court has said it's encouraged. It's encouraged.
Your company came up with the Santa Claus first, apparently.
Yes, sir.
Well, that was unique, I guess.
Well, it's a Santa Claus, so again, it's not that.
No, but it'd be pretty hard to argue that if they got the idea of Santa Claus, that you have to come up with a different looking Santa Claus. Santa Claus is, and you got there first, and
exactly.
Apparently that wasn't contested, was it?
No, because
wasn't
we can't.
The problem with Santa Claus, the trademark, the pull-my-finger issue?
Yeah, there was no problem with the doll. We came out with it first, and they didn't accuse that of copying because we came out first. It was the hang tag that says, pull-my-finger,
right.
Santa.
Okay.
By the time we introduced this product, they didn't have their trademark registration. We had introduced the product and then pulled it back off the market. It was in liquidation. They amended their complaint. We said, fine, who cares? We pulled the tags off and continued liquidating.
They contest that in their brief, though. They say there were a lot that still had the tags on.
The only ones that had the tags on were the ones that were retained for forensic purposes for the lawsuit. In closing argument, he pulled a clever stunt on the final argument of saying, well, gee, if they pulled the tags off, why is this one still on? Well, that's because my law firm, kept ones with the tag on for purposes of the trial. But You know, they didn't have any evidence of that. They came down and inspected, and all the tags were off. I mean, we're not looking for trouble. You know, people don't buy these junk toys because it says pull my finger on there. I'm like, oh, gee, that's a powerful brand like Ralph Lauren. I'm going to buy that doll. And so,
well, but trademarks, you know, some trademarks are Ralph Lauren and other trademarks are not. I mean, if it's a protectable trademark, it's protectable.
On the attorney's fees, $575,000 is not reasonable for a $271,000 verdict. The district court's opinion notably didn't even discuss the three most important legal touchstones. This court has said the best evidence is the actual agreement reached in the marketplace between the corporation and the plaintiff's lawyer. The Supreme Court in the Farrar case said a court is obligated to give primary consideration to the amount of fees vis-a-vis the recovery.
But maybe the starting point, though, under Blanchard and other cases, when you have a statute that permits fee shifting, the court seems quite clear that you don't have to start with a contingent fee agreement. And my impression of this very long and thoughtful special master opinion is that he's pretty careful going through how many hours are spent on this, how many hours are spent on that. He penalizes them for not turning over their contingent fee agreement. You know, he cuts hours here and there, and he comes up with a lodestar number of hours times the fees.
Let me give you one example. They spent 442 hours on the final pretrial order. That's 11 40-hour weeks just on the final pretrial order.
But
that's not reasonable.
He reduces by 25% the lodestar hours for the final pretrial order. And also, I don't see you with sort of a second-level argument here saying, first of all, we think it should have been contingent fee, but secondly, here are the specific items that we think were too high. You know, had you done that, you know, maybe we could have picked apart that ultimate order, but you didn't do that.
Well, we pointed out that our lodestar analysis, a proper lodestar analysis, equaled $196,000 in
right,
fees.
But I'm telling you, what you didn't do was say, here is an item, you know, final pretrial order, he gave 400 hours on it, should have been 250. I mean, what you didn't go through, and maybe you reasonably didn't, because these are abuse of discretion kinds of standards, but...
And exactly. This is an appellate court. He's got to apply the right legal standards.
He did. If it's right to start with the lodestar and it's right to make an evaluation of a sensible number of hours, what is it that the special master and then the district court did wrong?
Because this is not the lodestar. The time records they wrote down and the hourly rate, those documents existed for one purpose, this fee petition. They were not real invoices sent to the defendant. This is funny money. Those records, I'm not saying they fabricated. I'm not going to go into trying to prove that. But 442 hours for a final pretrial conference? I mean, imagine the incentives. You're a lawyer. You know you've got a contingency fee case. If you win, you're going to get fee shifting. No one is checking the reality of the time records. The lodestar analysis presupposes reasonable time and presupposes reasonable hourly rates. So
well,
when
did you argue to the special master and then the district court that the records themselves were unreliable?
In detail. We include
in
our appendix all of those for
right,
your court's review.
And see, again, that's a factual determination that the court has to make. And if the court thinks they're reliable enough, and this judge does seem to think that, says, well, there was an awful lot of time spent in this case. Much of it the judge seems to think was wasted, but be that as it may.
The judge didn't even compare the $291,000 recovery, which included $50,000.
Why should he have done that, though, if it took a certain number of hours to reach that recovery?
Because the Supreme Court says the primary thing you have to look at is the amount recovered compared to the amount of fees. There's no way you can spend $575,000 reasonably to recover $291,000. The jury gave them all of our profits on the Santa product and gave them lost profits. I mean, the accounting numbers were never seriously contested. I mean, the verdict amount was very predictable. And yet they went in and asked the jury to award $1.3 million. Well, the wisdom of the jury said that's ridiculous. They gave them 22%, including punitive damages. They put the case beyond the realm of settleable, beyond the realm of reasonable, and then they had no incentive to check the balance of their legal fees because they knew their client wasn't going to be paying it. And the Supreme Court in Delaware Valley said, well, you've got that fee-shifting situation. The court has to step in and play the role of the client, keeping in check and balance. You know, did they spend a sensible amount of time? is $80,000 between the first fee petition and the second fee petition? You say, well, the court cut that back. He cut it back to $60,000. $60,000 in legal fees between the first fee petition and the second fee petition? The court characterized it as time, so obviously well spent. That is not reasonable. I mean, this is just so out of whack that, you know, to award $575,000 on it, $291,000, where there was no finding of willfulness on the copyright. I mean, we ought to win on the copyright case. When you carve out this, or at a minimum, give us a remand. I mean, the district court made all kinds of factual findings against us, inferring that we had access, that the artist, Mary Burkhart, had access under the corporate receipts doctrine.
But the district court also, in a sense, I'm not sure whether corporate receipt is the right way to put it, or co-creator, because as the court sees it, Mr. Green stands there and dictates. I mean, he's the one who saw it, and he has somebody else's hand implement it. So that's not quite corporate receipt in the sense of some office at Procter & Gamble gets an idea and somebody else in a completely different department implements it.
I agree. It's not like he was totally divorced from the process, but they're not even very much divorced from the process. No, ma'am. They make 1,000 products a year. He doesn't have the time to get in detail and micromanage it. So,
and the record,
if you look at the record, don't look at their characterizations in the brief, look at the record of his degree of involvement. It was trivial, as you'd expect with a president of a corporation that imports 1,000 different products a year. And the corporate receipts doctrine is the doctrine the district court expressly relied on, when in fact it's a doctrine to defeat summary judgment, not to grant summary judgment. I see I'm into a rebuttal time.
Fine.
Thank you.
Here. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The defendant, Novelty Incorporated, is in the business of going out and finding products in the marketplace or in the process of being sent to the marketplace, making an assessment of what's likely to be very popular, copying them, and getting them to market as quickly as it can. It has a superior distribution network of convenience stores. That's what it does.
But, of course, a lot of companies do that. I mean, one of the cases that's cited in both briefs is the Mattel case about the Barbies. And there are lots of knockoff Barbie dolls out there that don't look quite as pretty. And, you know, the little girl, maybe they don't have clothes that are quite as good. But as long as they're different enough, they can be out there. And little girls like playing with fashion dolls, and that's that. So the fact that they like to copy successful ideas in and of itself doesn't strike me as all that unusual.
I agree with that, Your Honor. But by way of background,
and certainly not illegal. I mean, it's all over the place.
I think that's right. But to lay the fact scenario out and to get to the specific creation of Novelty's Fartman, here's what's in the record, and this is in Mr. Green's deposition. He stated that he saw Pull My Finger Fred in Hong Kong in the manufacturer's showroom in 2001. Although he doesn't recall for sure, he says he possibly took a photograph of it because it wouldn't be unusual to photograph everything he sees while on one of these trips. He then went back and talked to Mary Burkhart. And regarding what he told Mary Burkhart, here's what Mary Burkhart said in her deposition. This is how she described it. He included at least this much description. He wanted a farting guy that would have sound and motion when he farted, a plush doll that would fart and shake, make a sound, a hillbilly type guy sitting in a chair that would fart and be activated by actually pulling his finger. That's what was, by Ms. Burkhart's admission, communicated to her.
Well, what if you work for Novelty and you want to come up with a doll that would essentially do the same thing that Uncle Fred does? How would you design that doll that would get as close to infringement as possible but not cross over?
Well, just going from the description that Ms. Burkhart says she was given, looking at this, take a hillbilly type guy. Okay, I don't know if you would view Fartman as the stereotypical hillbilly type guy or not. When I think of hillbilly, I think of, you know,
now,
the Beverly.
Take just look at Uncle Fred and tell me how you change Uncle Fred.
So well, for example, you could have him, you know, instead of dressed just like Fred. If you want a hillbilly type guy, you can have him wearing bib overalls. Maybe he's not wearing any shoes. Maybe have him holding a shotgun or a jug of moonshine. If you want him sitting on something, which most of these dolls are like Santa here, they don't sit on anything but their bottoms. But if you wanted him sitting on something, he could sit on a bale of hay.
What if you took Uncle Fred and all you did was not have his finger extended and have a hat on, and you press the hat and it makes a sound. Would that be infringement?
I don't know.
You're the lawyer. Here you tell me. I want to know how close they can get, in your view, without crossing the line.
Well, it's a good question, Your Honor. I don't know that I'm really. Admittedly, I'm a lawyer. I litigate copyright cases, but I don't know if I can give you a really good analysis of that on the fly. If you're telling me you're going to get rid of the finger activation and have it squeeze his belly and put some other kind of hat on him, maybe change his posture, at some point you're going to introduce enough small differences that you will have avoided a substantial similarity of expression.
But that's the whole problem, because you have to articulate, A, what that is, and B, when there are genuine issues of fact. I mean, we can all sit here and identify differences between the two products. It's very easy to do that. And whether those are differences that, I mean, there's a lot of money on the line here. And to say the hat, you know, makes the difference between, you know, practically $900,000 or not, that's an important hat. Or any of these other things you're discussing, since we all know that ideas are not copyrightable. You all can recite all these things, but you've got to bring it down to the ground and tell us, when are there issues of fact that some trier of fact has to find out? When can the district court judge just sit there and say, oh, they look alike to me? You know, I mean, that's a little unsatisfactory.
Well, we've got two elements to prove. The first is copying. I don't think there's any dispute about that. Copying is admitted.
Well, copying, they say, yes, we admit copying of the idea, but we don't admit copying of the expression of the idea, and that's an important difference.
Right. Well, I mean, it's sort of changed. I mean, in their opening brief, they said, you know, there was an issue of fact as to whether the act of copying occurred. Now, in their reply and at oral argument, it's a little different.
I think they're just trying to refine it. I think they've always said, they've never contested that Mr. Green saw Fred in Hong Kong and that he went back and thought, oh, that's funny, you know, we can do that too. But you've agreed that, you know, just some doll that farts isn't copyrightable. I mean, if they come up with a completely different doll and he's wearing bib overalls and he's, you know, got a straw hat on, or he's got his sleeves rolled up with a pack of cigarettes stuck in him or whatever. He looks different, and he sits in a truck cab. That's not Fred, right? You wouldn't have said that was an infringing product, would you?
I'd have to see it, but based on your description, as I said, obviously at some point you will introduce enough differences. You can see it in my own client's product line, or you can see it, you've got Santa Claus. My client also has a Dracula doll. Has some Freddie Jr. and so on. So
the Dracula doll looks a lot like the Count on Sesame Street, I might add. But that that's maybe your problem for another day. If Novelty had made Frankie and you had never made it, would you have said Frankie infringed?
They're pretty close. I would say yes.
It's blonde hair, red and white striped tank top, straight line mouth, tattoo, and no chair.
Yeah.
So it's really the idea you're trying to protect, farting doll.
Oh no, I wouldn't say that at all. If they succeed in creating a different character. And maybe Frankie's different enough that it
fart?
Wouldn't.
Can he fart? I mean,
well, of course.
Say, okay.
Of course. And the finger activation. The point is, there's no end to the available personas or characters that one can create within this genre. So to get the idea and say, yeah, we want to enter that market as well, no problem. We all agree with that. But at some point, you do come too close. And this one, they hit him pretty close. And so,
if Fartman was just sitting with his hands folded and had a red dot on his chest and said, push me, or something like that, and it did everything it does after it tells a joke and so on, would that be infringing Uncle Fred?
So if you just if he's exactly the same as he is,
he doesn't have an extended finger, he's just sitting there and he's got a red circle on his chest and it says push me.
Part of Fred's name is, the brand name he sold under is Pull My Finger Fred, which implies that there's something going on with his finger being extended.
Fartman doesn't have that.
In your hypothetical, you've taken that element out of it. So he's just, the pull my finger part is not going to contribute to the ordinary observer's impression of overall similarity. So my answer to you is that might be enough to make it different.
See,
enough.
I have to always say might be.
Right. You have to agree sooner or later that one of these things is different, or you will be backed into the corner of trying to claim that anything that farts is covered by your copyright, which you have disclaimed. So there needs to be something that is on the other side of this line.
I agree with that.
Judge Evans is giving you lots of good examples.
Well, and I agree with that, Your Honor. And actually, I think your point about which one, the fellow with the tattoo,
Frankie,
that's probably well taken. That is an example of a different character. And that's what we're really talking about. Mm-hmm. And even if you say, well, what we want to do is we want to copy that, and we want to have a sort of regular guy persona, a sort of a Joe Lunchbucket guy like Fred depicts. You've still got plenty of different ways of doing that. That's why we have different characters. In that, these aren't pull my finger dolls, but I can think of Archie Bunker as a classic along those lines, and Homer Simpson is a more recent example, and those are people's different expressions of essentially the same type of character.
Fartman had a sex change and was Fart Woman in a dress with the finger extended, would that violate the copyright of?
No, I think you would you've got a different character, and that one probably would come with a sidekick therapist as well, given the sex change operation. But
they'd
yeah.
probably call him Part Man, wouldn't they?
A lot of different choices. So, the fundamental point there is, and back to the issue of copying, what's really happening is, you do have one element, which is the act of copying, which is the absence of independent creation. And there's no question that Fartman was created with reference to the copyrighted work. No question about that. It wasn't independent of it. So then the only question becomes the one that we've been discussing, which is substantial similarity.
I wonder if you could turn in a minute to these astronomical attorney's fees. It really seems like quite a generous award for the degree of success you got vis-a-vis what you were asking for. You won, technically, but the Supreme Court has said, if you ask for the moon and you only get a pebble, then that ought to be reflected in the fees. Maybe you got more than a pebble, but you got a lot less than you asked for.
Well, the amount represented is what we asked for. I think it's exaggerated
because
we left the punitive damages open-ended.
Right, the damages you requested, though, were quite high, and you got the 291 by the time everything was added up. And then you get this very high, $575,000 and some, attorney's fees, which seems like a lot of money to me.
Yes, Your Honor, on the issue of success, we moved for a preliminary injunction. We obtained that. On every claim that we pursued, we prevailed. We were successful in obtaining summary judgment on the copyright infringement count.
I understand that, but I guess the concern is how many of your hours is the other side supposed to subsidize? Because, you know, pretty much for most of us, if we spent twice as long working on something, then maybe we would do a better job, but maybe not twice as good a job. And courts reviewing attorney's fees requests have to exercise some judgment as to whether someone spent more than was strictly necessary. Doesn't mean you didn't prevail, but was it really necessary to spend all those hours?
Well, Your Honor, this case was characterized by a very vigorous defense. No stone was left unturned as far as arguments that were made. You know, just as an example, it continues to this day. The story you heard about the hang tags being removed, the fact is that every single Santa that was brought into that courtroom had a hang tag on it. The story about the hang tags being removed was just that. It was a story. There was no documentation. There wasn't a photograph of it. When counsel told you that we went down and inspected them and verified the hang tags that were removed, that did not happen. So, you know, this is just that's just one example. Against a determined defense, they can put you through your paces. And the fact that we asked for, you know, more monetary damages than we actually got, we're still very successful. You know, including an award of punitive damages and findings that the infringement was willful, not only the trademark infringement, but the copyright infringement as well. So, I wouldn't characterize this case at all as largely unsuccessful. We got most of what we asked for.
Is there any evidence about the value of the injunction?
None that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I don't know how we would have placed a monetary value on it.
Well, they pulled the product or something at some point, didn't they?
Well, they say they pulled the product. They removed them from the retail distribution, but they have then, after they remove them from that, they still keep selling them through a liquidation process. And you know, the fact is, if they weren't selling the product and they didn't intend to, and they didn't care about it and they were never going to sell it again and it was dead, then when injunctive relief was sought, the easy, quick answer to that is go in and just say, Your Honor, we don't oppose it because we don't care. And I suggested that as a way to work around it, and that didn't happen. Instead, it was fully opposed. So, to wrap up, I think you have to I don't know how you would quantify, and I don't know of any cases that look at that number and say, well, here the plaintiff asked for $500,000, the jury only came back with $250,000 or whatever the number is. So that means that when we evaluate attorney fees, here's how we apply that. And here's the percentage of hours that we're going to find were not reasonably spent. So I understand what you're saying, and it's like a lot of the arguments that we're hearing from Novelty. Well, this is unreasonable in light of you know, the overall size of the case and the damages. But I don't know of any authority, and I don't know of I haven't heard a proposal that says this is how you apply a rule like that.
But, you know, it's a little troublesome that you didn't disclose the contingent fee agreement, not because it was a cap, but because it's some evidence of what the market value of this case was.
A
piece of evidence, but the percentage wasn't disclosed.
Your Honor, that was by agreement. You'll notice the record doesn't contain, it contains a motion to compel the production of that. And then I talked with counsel, and I said, you know, what's the relevance? And they said, well, look at that assessment technologies case. I looked at it, and I said, okay, from that case, it looks like the court has said, you know, if there's a cap in the agreement or if there's a flat fee component, then that's going to be relevant. But that case, the assessment technologies case, says that the contingent fee, the percentage rate in the agreement, is not going to be used as a cap. And we've got all these Supreme Court cases saying we don't look to the contingent fee, we look to the lodestar. So I said, okay, we can give that to you. I can represent to you it doesn't have a fixed fee component. It doesn't have a cap. It's a straight percentage deal. So under the case you've given me, it doesn't have any relevance because that's what that case says. And counsel said, okay, that sounds fine to me. I said, and the offer was, I'm going to give it to you, but we're going to redact the percentage. And that's what we did. And it was never presented to the district court. There was no complaint made saying, well, Your Honor, that percentage is highly relevant to our theory here on the fee petition. Mm-hmm. That all sort of came after they got it. If there are no further questions, I'll conclude.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Voters.
This is not a lawsuit between the starving artists. It's two corporations fighting over the money. I study your opinions. I advise my client. They're in the business of making these kind of products. Your Honor asked, how close is enough? How are we to know? That's the right question. You've said so. This court has said so in the Atari case, and I've summarized it at page 4-5 of our reply brief in this table. You articulated very clearly how much is idea, how much is scenes affair. We compare that to how much we say is idea, how much they say scenes is affair. Before your very eyes, plaintiff's counsel couldn't articulate the idea, and yet my client is getting clobbered for nearly $1 million because, you know, maybe, you know, if it were remanded, we might win, we might lose. But if you read their characterization of the idea that the district court followed, plush doll making farting sounds and articulated jokes when the finger is activated. That's it, according to them. Count Fartula would be encompassed. In other words, this would be an infringement of Count Fartula, and Count Fartula would be an infringement of this. What their first answer was right. That's the problem. The judge gave too little to the public domain. As Your Honor pointed out, the burden of proof is on them. In baseball parlance, the tie goes to the runner. This is business litigation. We need to know where the line is. Now, I understand there's some gray area, but if before you hit us for $1 million, we ought to be able to know where the line is. My client doesn't like federal court litigation. Sure, he wants to copy ideas. Don't vilify them for copying ideas. The Supreme Court doesn't say that's neutral. They say that's good. We're in a capitalist, competitive society. My client offered these products for nearly one-fourth of the price of their products. People like that. That's called competitive, you know, capitalism. The extended finger seems to be a point, Your Honor, that you seem to think is a point of novelty. The undisputed evidence, their president testified, and the book, The Cultural History of the Fart, if you can believe that, acknowledges that part of the pull my finger gag is the extended finger. So that is not something that's new and original and creative with them, and therefore you shouldn't use that as a basis to say, well, you know, I think that's where you cross the line. If you push the hat, or if you had your hands crossed, you wouldn't infringe. To pull my finger is the very essence of the idea.
Wait, you did start your rebuttal by talking about these are two companies doing battle here.
Yes.
I thought your company was a lot bigger. Am I wrong?
We are big. We have 300 employees.
300 some employees, right. And this is just a small operation.
I mean, they have 400,000 unit sales at $20 a piece, according to the record.
No. The company itself.
Yes.
You started your rebuttal.
That's
got
right.
Up and said this is a battle between these two companies, these two corporations.
We are larger, yes.
Much larger.
Yes, 300 employees.
And what do they have?
I think two or three.
Two or three.
But the point is, this is a commercial dispute, and businesses need to know where the line is. And it's this. I won't say this. It's this court's job to articulate the line. You already have in Atari. And when you apply your own precedent to this facts, we win as a matter of law. And at most, it would remand for a question of facts. And you don't just remand and say, well, there's a question of fact, figure it out. This court needs to articulate the legal standard of, okay, here is the unprotectable idea, here's the unprotectable scenes affair, these little tidbits that maybe remain are the only thing that the jury needs to find, and they need to find, did Mary Burkhart actually copy? Remember, copy is a verb. Did she have this or a photograph of this in front of her when she was designing this? It isn't like a patent case where, well, I don't care whether they had, you know, side-by-side comparison. Copying is a verb. Access and substantial similarity are merely subordinate facts that allow but do not compel the finder of fact to say, you know, given those circumstances, we conclude that Mary Burkhart really did engage in the act of copying. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, both counsel. In this case, we take it under advisement.